for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate today. In the wake of 9/11, the U.S. government, led first by the Bush administration, but then later by President Obama, put in place a sprawling domestic and international security apparatus that is largely hidden from view, potentially uncontrollable and expensive. But hard facts and figures on what exactly it does, who works there, and how much it costs are all secret. Washington Post reporter Dana Priest and William Arkin have investigated the size and scope of the national security state in their new book called Top Secret America. It's published by Little Brown & Company, and I'm pleased to welcome Dana Priest to the show. Good to see you.
I'm glad to be here.
Getting a lot of buzz about this book. There was a television special as well on PBS about it.
That's right, a one-hour documentary.
You write in the book, quote, "People seem not to notice the incremental changes taking place across the country, the eroding of privacy and the tabulation of personal information in government hands." What kinds of changes are you talking about?
Well, domestically in particular, this has been an incremental sort of creeping change. Look at the Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security's See Something, Say Something campaign that you see posters for all over the place. That's attached to something that you don't see that much, which is report suspicious activities. There are these reports that are filled out by local police and sheriff's office and normal citizens that go into an FBI database eventually and can contain the names of thousands of individuals who've really done nothing wrong except perhaps act suspiciously. What does that mean? Taking a picture of a bridge, walking in front of a federal building too often. In the book, we talk about a family who took a picture of a Middle Eastern-looking family who took a picture of a fire boat in Los Angeles in a harbor, and the license plate was run down by the police department, and the man who owns the car, he's now in the database. He doesn't know it. He can't find out anything about it. And they can accumulate information, a lot of it now commercially available, about him, his social security number, where he's lived, all that sort of thing, and do nothing with it, just keep it there until later they might get other information. But there is a surveillance going on now. I call it a dragnet approach to counterterrorism that is being led by the Department of Homeland Security.
And these changes, is this by legislative action? Is this part of the Patriot Act, executive order? How did it come about that these changes occurred?
Yes to all that. it's Patriot Act, but it's also members of Congress funding the Department of Homeland Security to do this, so they have to sign off on it. But it's an executive branch initiative, and it's in response to what Janet Napolitano, the head of that department, says is homegrown terrorists, the threat from homegrown terrorists. It's a threat they talk very vaguely about. And I get the impression that anyone who's crazy and who has access to explosives could be called a terrorist these days. And the question that we pose in the book is, shouldn't we have a more honest and transparent discussion about the threat so we know what it is and what we're spending money to try to figure out?
In this time that it seems like the two parties particularly don't agree on anything, there's complete bipartisan support for this, right?
You know, it's curious, but the Republican media, the conservative media, has responded quite interested in the book and in the series that the Washington Post did before that, as I think partly a symbol of government run amok. And then some of the presidential candidates on the Republican side have been talking about the Department of Homeland Security in particular wasting money, because apart from the things we just talked about, they are building a building that when it's done will be larger than the Pentagon. There are so many people that work in the department and people who work with them in the intelligence world who really have been doing this for a long time, you know, ask me, what are they doing? Or they ask each other, you know, we don't see the impact on our life and our work. And that department happens to also have more than 50% contractors. 50% are people who are brought in from the from the outside.
From the private sector.
From the corporations that do this sort of work.
You have a glossary at the beginning, which was actually one of the more startling things in the book, only because if you asked me, and I think if you asked citizens, well, what agencies are we talking about? And I think people would say CIA, FBI, right?
Right.
Can I just read part of them?
Please, no one's ever brought that up. I love it.
Central Command, Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Critical Infrastructure Program for Finance, the Department of Homeland Security, Defense Intelligence Agency, the Department of Defense, the FBI, the Federal Investigative Services Division, Geospatial Intelligence. I'm only up to I's at this point. We haven't got to JSOC, the National Counterterrorism Center. I mean, there's dozens of these, right?
Well, and of course, our good editors at Little Brown said, you can't use all of these acronyms because people won't read the book, and they wouldn't. I mean, not the ones there, but there were three times as many there that we could have put in the book because there are so many agencies now with different, you know, the alphabet soup. It is dumbfounding, and people within the government, it's a symbol too, people within the government don't know what's around them because so much has grown up since 9/11.
I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate. We're talking to Dana Priest. Her book is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. Is there an idea of how really vast and big this is? I've given a few names, but the number of people, I mean, you've said from the beginning, almost it's almost impossible to tell. What can you tell us?
Well, we started to look at this in order to get our arms around it, and we developed a methodology. Bill Arkin, who is my co-author and just an amazing researcher, put together a database that is really the skeleton for all of this. We started at the secret level. We wanted to say, let's see what's in the secret world, but there was so much there, so many operations, so many programs, we went to the top secret level because we thought we'd never get all of them. And at the top secret level, there are about 1,200 federal organizations that work on top secret programs for counterterrorism and intelligence, which is the world we looked at. There are another 2,000 corporations that together have thousands of offices throughout the country, but 2,000 corporations that do work for them, and nearly 900,000 people have top secret clearance. That's larger than the whole population of Washington, D.C., and millions have secret clearance, but at the top secret level, it's about 900,000.
And there's a lot of these buildings, and a lot of the buildings are secret as well.
Right.
How did you find them?
Well, first of all, it's from public sources. That's not easy to find, but they're publicly available. The easier ones to describe are contracts and government websites and company websites. The more interesting to talk about are that top secret website, monster.com, where you can go and put in top secret in the search engine and find...
Just the job search.
Yep.
All right. So I go to... I'm looking for a job, but if I want to find out what other information, what do?
You just put in top secret in the job search in monster.com, and you will see thousands, unless they've changed it recently, thousands of jobs for people with top secret clearances. And that gives you some idea. You'll also see, as we did, and we're very shocked to see it, a lot of code names for secret operations. It doesn't tell you what they are, but it is advertising for people with knowledge of certain types of technical programs.
Not so secret, it sounds like.
No,
to me.
No. But when you cross-reference them with all this other stuff that we gathered, that's when you start to put something together that we always thought of as a genome project. You know, we're mapping the DNA of this world. And in the end, we got addresses in the end and put them everything on a map. And you can see that at the Washington Post website where we did the original work for this. And we create from the map what I call an alternative geography of the United States, where the capital is not Washington. It's above Washington in south of Baltimore, focused on Fort Meade and the National Security Agency, which is the country's eavesdropping agency around the world. And it really has the densest concentration of sub-agencies and also contractors that have gathered near it to work with it.
Have you heard from the government at all in the release of this information since the book has come
out? Well, we showed them our database, and we walked through with them how we got the information and what the information was. We basically gave them everything that we had and said, okay, and I do this all the time when I'm writing about classified information or sensitive information, because you don't want to do something you're not realizing you're doing and put somebody in danger. And in this case, we wanted to know what they thought we should withhold. The decision is ours. It's the Washington Post editor's decision or the publisher's decision. And they came back and said, we don't want you to run any of this. And so that was not a way to deal with it, we thought. It's a very fascinating topic and very much in the public interest. So as we always do anyway, we made our own decisions based on using people in the community and the intelligence world that I've known for years to be sort of our consiglieres, but ultimately deciding, you know, not to show all the details that we knew because for security reasons, but to show as much as we could, and in order to illuminate a world that by its very nature is not supposed to be seen by you.
If you actually drove around D.C. or this area of Baltimore or New York City and you knew where these buildings were that house these programs, what do they look like?
Well, they're hiding in plain sight. They look like office parks, except I have to say that the first time I went to what became known to us as the Stensis area, it did have a different quality about it, mainly because most of the offices don't have names of companies or agency names on the outside. They just have numbers, and then they have special glass, and they have, you know, special security around them and all that sort of stuff. And so it does look very strange, very alien. In fact, I took one of my editors along once because I thought I'd kind of lost my mind, you know, that I was become too obsessed with this. And I was seeing things everywhere. Well, within the first 15 minutes, her mouth was hanging open. And she was saying, this is so strange. You know, it really is, because it has a different character about it. And then I got to go inside. You know, that was the hard part, of course, because these are top secret. They're not going to let me in. But I did get to go inside some places, like the Defense Intelligence Agency, which let me take a class with other federal employees on keeping secrets secret in a meeting setting, for instance, so I could get the flavor of what it was, of the gigantic effort it takes.
I'm just thinking of the irony that they know a reporter was in right. A seminar called Keeping Secrets Secret.
Right. And it was there that in that classroom happened to be located in this dense hub that I'm talking about, which is how I discovered the hub to begin with. I just drove over there and I'm like, whoa, I've never seen this before.
And you make the point in the book, you go to these office parks and they're like three or four floors high.
Right.
But they go far down?
Well, you know, some of them have underground shopping malls, underground places to eat and that sort of thing. One of my favorites is the Director of National Intelligence, which was created on the recommendation of the 9/11 Commission, created by Congress and the President, to get their arms around this world that was growing so much after 9/11 and to put somebody in charge. Well, they didn't really give him the authority to be in charge, so that person in that office really is much less effective than it could be. But their building now is gigantic and a symbol to me of how big this world has grown. It's an quote-unquote undisclosed location, so you're not supposed to be able to find it. But I'd been over there for interviews, and when we sent the photographer there, the leaves had fallen off the trees because it was winter, so he got a good shot. But he also almost got arrested and his cameras confiscated. You can see it in the book. There's a great picture. It's 500,000 square feet, a fact we learned from the construction company that built the building. That's the equivalent to 5 Walmarts stacked on top of each other, which is an awful lot of space for an awful lot of people doing things that, again, don't get high marks from insiders within the community.
And the map you mentioned that shows where a lot of these agencies are in America, we put a link on our show page so
great.
People can take a look at that. I'm speaking with Washington Post investigative reporter Dana Priest about the book Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State, which she's co-authored with fellow Post reporter William Arkin. The book, which is published by Little Brown, grew out of a series of reports that were published last year in the Washington Post. We'll be back with more after a break. I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate. My guest is Dana Priest, and along with William Arkin, their book is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. These are not just governmental agencies. These there are several corporations that have gotten involved. You mentioned that a little bit earlier. Which corporations and what do they do?
Well, there are about 2,000 of those several corporations who do the work of government. They were supposed to help government, be the support agencies, do the IT, do the administration of certain things. But after 9/11, within days, Congress basically wrote a blank check to many of its agencies saying, you know, do what it takes to make sure this doesn't happen again. And both President Bush and Congress didn't want it to appear as if government were growing because they thought that would politically not be a good thing. So they said, go hire contractors. So that's what they did. They went and hired thousands of contractors very quickly and put them to work in not just the support areas, but in every area. There's rules that say inherently governmental functions, that's the term, shouldn't be done by contractors. But every intelligence agency now is dependent on people who are working for private profit-making companies to do our work. My favorite example is there's a wall at the CIA where they have engraved stars for people who have been killed in the line of duty. And of the 22 stars there engraved since 9/11, 8 of the 22 are for contractors who have been involved in CIA covert operations on behalf of the government, but working for private companies. So a lot of the biggest ones have the largest chunk of this, and those are names that by and large you might recognize, the old line defense firms, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, L3 Communications. They used to only bend steel to make submarines and aircraft, and they quickly, after 9/11, got into the IT and information space, and they really dominate there. And by the way, they are hugely profitable in this moment of economic recession. These companies have been doing phenomenal. And
you mentioned that they're profitable twice now, and I have to ask, are these contractors then really more, do they have more allegiance to the shareholders or to us as people, since the bottom line is they're supposed to be keeping us safe?
That's why they weren't allowed, or they weren't supposed to be allowed, to do these very sensitive things. Leon Panetta, when he was director of the CIA, I interviewed him for the book and series, and he said that worried him, that he wanted to decrease the number of contractors because they aren't first, their first allegiance is to their companies. So, and that also worried Secretary Gates when he was at the Defense Department. I talked to him and he told me this pretty embarrassing tale. He was embarrassed, he said, to tell me about it, which is that he asked his staff to get him the number of contractors that worked in his personal office, the Office of Secretary of Defense. It's a big office with hundreds of people. They couldn't give him an answer. So he could not find out how many contractors were on his own staff. And that gives you an idea of how pervasive they are now. And it's difficult because a lot of the contractors use hundreds of subcontractors. And there's no way to get your arms around it. We estimate, and government people have said they think that we are correct, that of the nearly 900,000 who have top secret security clearances, about 250,000, a quarter of a million people, are actually contractors with those clearances.
So we have these big government agencies, a growing number of them, and a growing number of private companies that are into the security world, into top secret America. Do you have a philosophical viewpoint is actually what this means for us as a democracy?
Oh, I do. And that is based on the secrecy, not necessarily. One can debate, and we call out this in the book as well, whether we have the right mix, whether we're spending too much money in programs that don't do anything to keep us safe. But philosophically, the larger issue is the issue of secrecy, is the issue, an issue that I think undermines our democracy when government operates behind closed doors. Of course, there are secrets that need to be kept, but as every government commission has looked at, and many people within government say, there are too many secrets now, and this is not good for decision-making inside government, and certainly not good for public debate about these crucial issues.
And let's be specific for the people who are listening. Are we talking about every email everyone writes, phone calls, text messages? Is that being intercepted somewhere?
I have to say that I don't actually know the answer to that, but I would doubt that it is, because that's way too much. Right now, the National Security Agency has, because they've re-upped the new FISA law that came about because of the warrantless surveillance. They've made it easier to follow people who were connected to people overseas through communications. I do think these big databases that we're talking about are another way to, gather data on people, but not necessarily use it right now. So I don't think that we're talking about generalized surveillance of the population. There is a notion out there that that there is some program that's doing that. And I can't say for sure that there's not. I don't think there is. And if there were one, certainly nobody would have the time to go through all that. It would be something that would be put into a computer and crunched and filtered to try to find certain code words or certain words that might get an actual person's attention.
So the stuff that they are getting on the people that they want, I'm guessing it's easier to access it, to get that permission to go after the people that they want to target.
Exactly.
How does that work?
Well, it used to be when you were talking about criminal cases, which is the only reason that you could do that against Americans in the United States, that you had to have probable cause. You had to go to a judge and you had to get a warrant. So now, with the suspicious activities bar, if you will, it's lower. And there are rules, but the government won't show them to us. But it is definitely lower. At the same time, you've had this huge striking advance in technology. So there are commercial companies that can tell, that have your Social Security number and know in a second every place you've lived for the last 20 years. Well, the Washington Post has that, too, because we use that to do our investigations. That now is available if a local police department wants to buy that sort of commercial data. That can be available, too, and they can put that in a database as well. The third thing I want to say, because we didn't mention it yet, is the import of war-created technologies that helped warfighters in Iraq and Afghanistan to look at populations there in a given neighborhood and say, who really belongs here and who doesn't, or through checkpoints. Well, some of that has now is being sold by the same companies that created it for the military, is being sold to police and sheriff's departments, too. We're mainly talking about biometrics, fingerprints that can be taken at a distance or on little portable pads that some police departments, when you get stopped for a traffic violation, you'll be asked to put your fingerprint in, or even iris scans, and the databases that now collate and look at all these many thousands of bits of information and try to make patterns out of them.
Maybe we could be specific, too. We are still, as far as I know, under a threat here in New York after the 10th anniversary of 9/11, that we heard it was, credible, specific, but not confirmed, which I think was confusing to everyone. How did that information come to be known and then widely distributed to television and all of us and be aware of it here in New York?
Well, like it usually is, through the mechanism of government, through, in this case, the Department of Homeland Security, which is supposed to be, guarding the homeland, and the FBI, which usually takes a little bit of a less upfront profile on this. But, I think that this goes to the issue of the threat. I think we need a more descriptive issue of the threat. There are many of these agencies inside of the world we talk about, or some of them, have made us safer. They have almost destroyed the 9/11 al-Qaeda that existed. There are several hundred al-Qaeda left in the world. And yes, there are other groups that have come up since then. But these intelligence agencies really do have a much better handle on them than they did on al-Qaeda prior to 9/11. So the threat from overseas is not as great as it was. And inside the country, you know, they don't talk about anymore, although this can't be totally dismissed, Al-Qaeda networks. Now they're talking about usually individuals. So that's where...
It's the lone wolf,
I think. The lone wolf.
And does this entire apparatus that you describe thwart that?
I don't see evidence so far that this giant approach has much to do with thwarting individuals at all. What has thwarted individuals in the past is FBI counterterrorism agents who know how to do this work and who know what to do with a tip and who know how to cultivate informants. Sometimes they use local authorities to help them out, but more often it's their own experience that has netted a lot of these. And here in New York, you know, you would include the NYPD in that, in their terrorism unit, which is so steeped in these issues.
I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate today, talking to Dana Priest, along with William Arkin. Their new book is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. Can you put a dollar value on the cost of the new American security state?
I wish I could put a better dollar value on it. We know that the official figure is about $81 billion, which is about 250% larger than the intelligence budget was on 9/11. But that doesn't include the Department of Homeland Security, and it doesn't include some of the military's intelligence work, which, by the way, the CIA, which gets most attention, and the FBI are relatively small compared to the military. So I would guess, and it's not in the book because it is just an estimate, that we're really talking about at least $100 to $125 billion a year to fortify this effort. And then that doesn't even include state and local spending, which is, even in this tough time, being driven to some degree to work on terrorism because the Department of Homeland Security will give them money to work on terrorism.
Leo here in New York wants to know, are we doing a good job of keeping these secrets? I mean, he says, with all these people and infrastructure, you'd think we'd be leaking secrets constantly.
You know, it's not just the people. It's mainly that it could be many, you know, the people could be a problem, but it's technology as well. In the aftermath of WikiLeaks, the government's counterintelligence agents and apparatus looked at that. And what they found was shocking to them, which was that many of these intelligence agencies don't know that their systems are leaking, and they don't know who already has information, but they believe that many people do, and they haven't patched up the problems that they can even identify. So the problem is that while government has gone down the road of creating so many secrets, there is no way they can keep all those secrets secret. So even people whose job is to hunt down traitors and spies within the government say, you know, we're not going to win this. It's like putting, you know, the proverbial finger in the dike. And that really what we should do is decide what really needs to be secret, which is a very small fraction of all this, and to do everything we can to keep those secrets from leaking out.
I'd like to continue. We talked earlier about the bipartisan nature of this initiative. Do I remember it right that Barack Obama, as a candidate, argued against this sprawling national security state?
He did. He argued against the secrecy, and he argued against many of the efforts that were put in place by the Obama administration. Of course, he wanted to close Guantanamo and hasn't done that. He talked about the rule of law, and presumably he meant people going to some sort of court process if they were suspected of terrorism. He hasn't actually done that either because Guantanamo is still open. He has kept the secret prisons closed, and as far as I know, the rendition flights are not going on anymore into those places, although they probably are continuing to third countries that are our allies. But he, other than that, he's really followed the blueprint put
followed
in place.
Followed or expanded?
Followed and expanded the blueprint put in place by the Bush administration in the drone strikes, which he's increased, in the use of the Special Operations Forces called JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Forces, Those are the people that killed bin Laden. He's expanded the use of that, not just in countries where we're at war, but in countries where we're not at war, like Yemen and Pakistan and Somalia and Nigeria.
How many countries in all do we have these sort of covert activities going on?
Well, there are two dozen countries that were named early on and that were given given permission to these military people to work in these countries with future with future authorities. So at any one time, we probably have them only in several countries. But they're, you know, planning on other operations in at least two dozen countries.
You make an interesting distinction in the book between covert, clandestine, and secret. You want to describe the differences?
I know. It sounds like, I'm picking nits, but really this is so important because of the abuses in the past with the CIA, which does covert action, which is never supposed to be found out, and the whole point of all of their cover operations, the fake companies, you know, this sort of thing is to disguise these operations and the hand of the U.S. Because those have had problems in the past, the law says that they now have to, the president has to sign a presidential finding, and he has to give that to Congress, to the Intelligence Committee, saying, we need to do this now, and this is generally what we're doing. And then after the operations, he has to tell Congress, this is what we've done. And that is to have Congress be a second guard against abuses. But the military, when they do sometimes the exact same type of thing, because they're military and they're doing it, the lawyers say, within a military chain of command, they have not had to do the same thing. They don't need a presidential finding, and they haven't had to tell Congress about it. So they say what they're doing is clandestine, not covert, which means basically really secret. But it doesn't trigger the law that the CIA's actions trigger. Obama has changed that a little bit. He has now said, well, no matter what the lawyers say, it's probably a good idea to tell some members of Congress what these very special troops are doing. So he's started to do that.
Are we safer, or is this industrial complex in secrecy that you've described out of control?
Well, I think both are true. I think definitely we're safer than we were on 9/11. But we're not safer because of this huge, sprawling, top-secret America that we describe. We're safer because there are organizations, the counterterrorism agents at the FBI, certain parts of the National Security Agency, the CIA's people that work on counterterrorism, the special forces that know how to go and target individuals who are from Al-Qaeda. Those are a minority of the thousands of people we describe here. And there are many offices in here that don't seem to add, and this is from the inside, these are from people who get to work with them, don't seem to add to our safety. And I would argue because they don't, they're not only wasting money, but they're diverting attention and resources away from keeping us safer.
I've been speaking with Washington Post investigative reporter Dana Priest about Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State, the book she's co-authored with fellow Post reporter William Arkin. It's published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, my pleasure.